you for listening. You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Some men will allow the innocent to hang. They will turn traitor. They will lie, cheat, steal, and they will kill. They appear brilliant, charming, and generous, but they are deadly. Such are men as Demetrios. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America. Welcome to another hour of Sweet Liberty. And no, I'm not Jackie Petru. Jeff Bennett filling in for Jackie tonight, as we seem to be doing that way on Thursday nights. Glad to have you here aboard. You're listening to this hour live on FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the satellite Galaxy 13, channel 16, 7.7 audio. Hopefully, with any good luck, 100.3 FM radio, top of the rock, Canby, Idaho. And as always, on WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio, Nashville, Tennessee, U.S. of A. on 5.07 megahertz on your shortwave dial. And, oh, by the way, you can also pick the broadcast up at www.sweetliberty.org. We're going to return to Chapter 3 of The Mask of Demetrios tonight. Game, set, match. We've taken a two-week hiatus. It's now time to get back to work. Book written some years ago, which is available all over the internet, entitled The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And whether it be factual or a hoax, we're not raising during this program, but we are going to share with you one of the key protocols, which lends itself very closely to what this series, The Mask of Demetrios, is all about. Protocol number 20. Entry number 1. Today, the author begins, we shall touch upon the financial program, which I put off to the end of my report as being the most difficult, the crowning and decisive point of our plans. Before entering upon it, I will remind you that I have already spoken before by way of a hint when I said that the sum total of our actions is settled by the question of figures. For those of you who are not familiar with the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, it is purportedly a rather lengthy report written by, I could say, a Jew. More than likely, it's a Zionist. And it is purportedly the plans that the Zionist had laid out to control the Goy, the Goyim, you and I, those of us who are not of Jewish descent. Entry number 2. When we come into our kingdom, our autocrat government will avoid, from a principle of self-preservation, sensibly burdening the masses of the people with taxes. Remember that it plays the part of father and protector. But as state organization costs dear, it is necessary, nevertheless, to obtain the funds required for it. It will therefore elaborate with particular precaution the question of equilibrium in this matter. Our rule, in which the king will enjoy the legal fiction that everything in his state belongs to him, which may easily be translated into fact, will be enabled to resort to the lawful confiscation of all sums of every kind for the regulation of their circulation in the state. From this follows that taxation will best be covered by a progressive tax on property. In this manner, the dues will be paid without straitening or ruining anyone in the form of a percentage of the amount of property. The rich must be aware that it is their duty to place a part of their superfluities at the disposal of the state, since the state guarantees them security of possession of the rest of their property and the right of honest gains. I say honest, for the control over property will do away with robbery on a legal basis. This social reform must come from above, for the time is ripe for it. It is indispensable as a pledge of peace. And henceforth, we shall destroy capital. The tax upon the poor man is a seed of revolution and works to the detriment of the state, which is hunting after the trifling is missing the big. Quite apart from this, a tax on capitalists diminishes the growth of wealth in private hands, in which we have in these days concentrated it as a counterpoise to the government strength of the goyim, their state finances. A tax increasing on a percentage ratio to capital will give much larger revenue than the present individual or property tax, which is useful to us now for the sole reason that it excites trouble and discontent among the goyim. Well, ladies and gentlemen, now we know the real reason for the purpose of the 16th Amendment, do we not? The protocol continues. The force upon which our king will rest consists in the equilibrium and the guarantee of peace, for the sake of which things it is indispensable that the capitalists should yield up a portion of their incomes for the sake of the secure working of the machinery of the state. State needs must be paid by those who will not feel the burden and have enough room to take from. Such a measure will destroy the hatred of the poor man for the rich, in whom he will see a necessary financial support for the state, will see in him the organizer of peace and well-being, since he will see that it is the rich man who is paying the necessary means to attain these things. In order that the payers of the educated classes should not do too much to stress themselves over the new payments, they will have full accounts given them of the destination of those payments, with the exception of such sums as will be appropriated for the needs of the throne and the administrative institutions. He who reigns will not have any properties of his own, once all in the state represented his patrimony, or else the one would be in contradiction to the other. The fact of holding private means would destroy the right of property in the common possessions of all. Relatives of him who reigns, his heirs excepted, who will be maintained by the resources of the state, must enter the ranks of servants of the state, or must work to obtain the right to property. The privilege of royal blood must not serve for the spoiling of the treasury. Purchase, receipt of money or inheritance will be subject to the payment of a stamp progressive tax. Any transfer of property, whether of money or other, without evidence of payment of this tax, which will be strictly registered by names, will render the former holder liable to pay interest on the tax from the moment of transfer of these sums up to the discovery of his evasion of declaration of the transfer. Transfer documents must be presented weekly at the local treasury office with notifications of the name, surname, and permanent place of residence of the former and the new holder of the property. This transfer with a register of names must begin from a definite sum which exceeds the ordinary expenses of buying and selling necessaries, and these will be subject to payment only by a stamp imposed of a definite percentage of the unit. Just strike an estimate of how many times such taxes as these will cover the revenue of the goyim states. The state exchequer, typically a British word, will have to maintain a definite complement of reserve sums, and all that is collected above that complement must be returned into circulation. On these sums will be organized public works. The initiative in works of this kind, proceeding from state sources, will blind the working class firmly to the interests of the state and to those who reign. From these same sums, also a part will be set aside as rewards of inventiveness and productiveness. In the minds of the Jew, those who purportedly wrote the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, they believe distinctly that they, and they alone, can cause depressions. Now keep in mind, everything we've read to you so far talks about reigning and talks about the rulers, etc. This typically was written, we believe, as related to European monarchy, chiefly those in Britain. The protocol goes on to say, on no account should so much as a single unit above the definite and freely estimated sums be retained in the state treasuries, for money exists to be circulated, and any kind of stagnation of money acts ruinously on the running of the state machinery, for which it is the lubricant. A stagnation of the lubricant may stop the regular working of the mechanism. The substitution of interest-bearing paper for a part of the token of exchange has produced exactly this stagnation. The consequences of this circumstance are already sufficiently noticeable. The Court of Account will also be instituted by us, meaning the Jew. And in it, the ruler will find at any moment a full accounting for state income and expenditure, with the exception of the current monthly account, not yet made up, and that of the preceding month, which will not yet have been delivered. The one and only person who will have no interest in robbing the state is its owner, its ruler, and that is why his personal control will remove the possibility of leakages or extravagances. The representative function of the ruler at receptions for the sake of etiquette, which absorbs so much invaluable time, will be abolished in order that the ruler may have time for control and consideration. His power will not then be split up into fractional parts among time-serving favorites who surround the throne for its pomp and splendor and are interested only in their own and not in the common interest of the state. Economic crises have been produced by us for the goyim by no other means than the withdrawal of money from circulation. Huge capitals have stagnated, withdrawing money from states, which were constantly obliged to apply to those same stagnant capitals for loans. These loans burdened the finances of the state with the payment of interest and made them the bond slaves of these capitals. The concentration of industry in the hands of capitalists, out of the hands of small masters, has drained away all the juices of the peoples, and with them also the states. And now, you see, we begin to understand the purpose of the Federal Reserve Bank Corporation, do we not, my friends? The protocols continue. The present issue of money in general does not correspond with the requirements per head and cannot, therefore, satisfy all the needs of the workers. The issue of money ought to correspond with the growth of population, and thereby children almost must absolutely be reckoned as consumers of currency from the day of their birth. The revision of issue is a material question for the whole world. You are aware that the gold standard has been the ruin of the states which adopted it, for it has not been able to satisfy the demands for money. The more so that we have removed gold from circulation as far as possible. These are the words of the 20th protocol of the learned elders of Zion. Entry 23. With us, the standard that must be introduced is the cost of working man power, whether it be reckoned in paper or in wood. We shall make the issue of money in accordance with the normal requirements of each subject, adding to the quantity with every birth and subtracting with every death. The accounts will be managed by each department, each circle, in order that there may be no delays in the paying of our money for state. Needs, the sums and terms of such payments will be fixed by decree of the ruler. And this will do away with the protection by a ministry of one institution to the detriment of others. Entry 26. The budgets of income and expenditure will be carried out side by side that they may not be obscured by distance one to another. By the way, I've just discovered that this was written in relationship to the French monarchy, not the British. The reforms projected by us, the protocol continues, in the financial institutions and principles of the goyim will be clothed by us in such forms as will alarm no one. We shall point out the necessity of reforms in consequence of the disorderly darkness into which the goyim, by their irregularities, have plunged the finances. The first irregularity, as we shall point out, consists in their beginning with drawing up a single budget, which year after year grows owing to the following cause. This budget is dragged out to half the year. And they demand a budget to put things right. And this they expend in 3 months, after which they ask for a supplementary budget. And all this ends up with a liquidation budget. But as the budget of the following year is drawn up in accordance with the sum of the total addition, the annual departure from the normal reaches as much as 50% in a year. And so the annual budget is trebled in 10 years. Thanks to such methods allowed by the carelessness of the Goy states, their treasuries are empty. The period of loans supervenes, and that has swallowed up remainders and brought up all the Goy states to bankruptcy. By the way, my friends, if you're not aware of it, the United States was declared bankrupt at the Geneva Convention of 1929. If you doubt that, see 31 U.S. Code 5112, 5118, and 5119. The protocols continue. You understand perfectly that economic arrangements of this kind, which have been suggested to the Goyim by us, cannot be carried by us. Every kind of loan proves infirmity in the state and a want of understanding of the rights of the state. Loans hang like a sword of Damocles over the heads of rulers who, instead of taking from their subjects by a temporary tax, come begging with outstretched palms of our bankers. Foreign loans are leeches which there is no possibility of removing from the body of the state until they fall off of themselves or the state flings them off. But the Goy states do not tear them off. They go on in persisting in putting more onto themselves so that they must inevitably perish, drained by voluntary bloodletting. And so we provide the tyranny of usury. Because what also is needed is, in substance, a loan, especially a foreign loan. A loan is an issue of government bills of exchange, containing a percentage obligation commensurate to the sum of the loan capital. If the loan bears a charge of 5%, then in 20 years the state vainly pays away in interest a sum equal to the loan borrowed. In 40 years it is paying a double sum, in 60, triple, and all the while the debt remains an unpaid debt. And from this calculation, it is obvious that with any form of taxation per head, the state is bailing out the last coppers of the poor taxpayers in order to settle accounts with wealthy foreigners from whom it has borrowed money, instead of collecting these coppers for its own needs without the additional interest. So long as loans were internal, the Goyim only shuffled their money from the pockets of the poor to those of the rich. But when we bought up the necessary person in order to transfer loans into the external sphere, and in this case, of course, we could reference Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, all of the wealth of states flowed into our cash boxes, and all the Goyim began to pay us the tribute of subjects. If the superficiality of Goy kings, or in our country's case, presidents, on their thrones in regard to state affairs and the banality of ministers or the want of understanding of financial matters on the part of other ruling persons have made their countries debtors to our treasuries to amounts quite impossible to pay, it has not been accomplished without, on our part, heavy expenditure of trouble and money. Stagnation of money, the protocol continues, will not be allowed by us, and therefore will be no state interest-bearing paper except a 1% series, so that there will be no payment of interest to leeches that suck all the strength out of the state. The right to issue interest-bearing paper, in our case bonds, will be given exclusively to industrial companies who find no difficulty in paying interest out of profits, whereas the state does not make interest on borrowed money like those companies, for the state borrows to spend and not to use in operations. And according to one editor's comment, now we know why Kennedy was assassinated in 1963 when he refused to borrow any more of the banknotes from the bankers of the Federal Reserve Bank and began circulating non-interest-bearing notes of the United States of America. Industrial papers will be bought also by the government, which from being as now a paper of tribute by loan operations will be transformed into a lender of money at profit. The measure will stop the stagnation of money, parasitic profits, and idleness, all of which were useful for us among the goyim, so long as they were independent but are not desirable under our rule. How clear, the protocol continues, is the undeveloped power of thoughts of the purely brute brains of the goyim, as expressed in the fact that they have been borrowing from us with payment of interest without ever thinking that all these same years, very monies, plus an addition for payment of interest, must be got by them from their own state pockets in order to settle up with us. What could have been simpler than to take the money they wanted from their own people? But it is a proof of the genius of our chosen mind that we have contrived to present the matter of loans to them in such a light that they have even seen in them an advantage for themselves. Our accounts, which we shall present when the time comes, in the light of centuries of experience gained by experiments made by us on the Goy states, will be distinguished by clearness and definiteness and will show at a glance to all men the advantage of our innovations. They will put an end to those abuses to which we owe our mastery over the goyim, but which cannot be allowed in our kingdom. We shall so hedge about our system of accounting that neither the ruler nor the most insignificant public servant will be in a position to divert even the smallest sum from its destination without detection, or to direct it in another direction except that which will be once fixed in a definite plan of action. Is this, dear listener, I ask you, is this why a private corporation known as the Internal Revenue Service is in charge of collecting the payments of income taxes, and the IRS always deposits those payments to the Federal Reserve Bank and never to the Treasury of the United States? The protocol continues. And without a definite plan, it is impossible to rule. Marching along an undetermined road and with undetermined resources brings to ruin, by the way, heroes and demigods. The Goy rulers, whom we once upon a time advised should be distracted from state occupations by representative receptions, observances of etiquette, entertainments, were only screens for our rule. The accounts of favorite courtiers who replaced them in the sphere of affairs were drawn up for them by our agents, and every time gave satisfaction to short-sighted minds by promises that in the future economics and improvements were foreseen. Economics from what? From new taxes? Were questions that might have been but were not asked by those who read our accounts and projects. You know to what they have been brought by this carelessness. To what pitch of financial disorder they have arrived, notwithstanding the astonishing industry of their peoples. And that brings us to the end of the 20th protocol of the learned elders of Zion. I'll be back in a moment. W. Aldrich was a U.S. politician born in Foster, Rhode Island. Elected to Congress 1879 to 1881, after which the Rhode Island legislature chose him for a seat in the U.S. Senate, where he served from 1881 to 1911. By the turn of the century, he controlled the Senate for the Republicans on domestic issues, ruthlessly defending big business and a high protective tariff. Nelson W. Aldrich was once a very influential figure in Rhode Island politics. After having served as a member and Speaker of the House in the U.S. Congress, he took that position in the U.S. Senate in 1881. In 1908, he introduced an amendment to establish an income tax after he had denounced it as communistic in 1894. Aldrich was viewed as the authentic voice of J.P. Morgan, and was chief sponsor of the National Monetary Commission, the National Reserve Association, which eventually became the Federal Reserve System. There was a point in time in his life that Aldrich was referred to as the general manager of the United States. That's the power wielded by a Nelson W. Aldrich. He was seen as the embodiment of the Eastern establishment, the perception by Southern and Western states that the wealthy families and large corporations of the Northeast ran the country. By the way, his daughter later married the son of John D. Rockefeller. And our one-time vice president, Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, was named for his maternal grandfather, Nelson W. Aldrich. According to his own statements and the facts, Paul Warburg set out to reform the monetary system of the United States and, in fact, did so. He had the success, which comes to few men, of coming as an alien to the United States, connecting himself with the principal Jewish financial firm here in this nation, and immediately floating certain banking ideas which have been pushed and manipulated and variously adapted until they eventuated into what is now known as the Federal Reserve System. When Professor Seligman, who we spoke of in the last chapter, wrote in his Proceedings of the Academy of Political Science that the Federal Reserve Act will be associated in history with the name of Paul M. Warburg, a Jewish banker from Germany, Seligman wrote the truth. But whether that association will became such as to bring the measure of renown which Seligman implied, the future has yet to reveal. Because frankly, in this year of our Lord, 2004, nearly 100 years later, few people know the name of Paul Warburg in this country. What the people of the United States do not understand, my friends, and never have understood, is that while the Federal Reserve Act was governmental, the whole Federal Reserve System is private. It is an officially created private banking system. Examine the first 1,000 people you meet on the street, and 999 of them will tell you that the Federal Reserve System is a device whereby the United States government went into the banking business for the benefit of the people. The benefit of the people, mind you. They have an idea that, like the post office and the former custom house, a Federal Reserve Bank is part of the government's official machinery. It is natural to feel that this mistaken view has been encouraged by most of the men who are competent to write for the public on this question. Take up the standard encyclopedias, and while you will find no misstatements of fact in them, you will find no direct statement that the Federal Reserve System is a private banking system. The impression carried away by the lay reader is that it is part of the government. The Federal Reserve System, you see, is a system of private banks, the creation of a banking aristocracy within an already existing aristocracy, whereby a great proportion of banking independence was lost, and whereby it was made possible for speculative financiers to centralize great sums of money for their own purposes, beneficial or not. That this system was useful in the artificial conditions created by war. Useful, that is, for a government that cannot manage its own business and finances and, like a prodigal son, is always wanting money and wanting it when it wants it. It is proof, either by reason of its inherent faults or by mishandling, its inadequacy to the problems of peace. It has sadly failed of its promise and is now under serious question. Warburg's scheme succeeded just in time to take care of war conditions. He was placed on the Federal Reserve Board in order to manage his system in practice. And though he was full of ideas then as to how banking could be assisted, he later became disappointingly silent as to how the people could be relieved. After having just shared with you the relieved of their cash is more like it. Thanks for joining us for Chapter 3 of The Mask of Demetrios right here on Sweet Liberty. I'm Jeff Bennett, filling in for Jackie Petru, who's relaxing on Thursday nights for a while. It's probably about the first time I've gone back and listened to this series since we recorded it. I hope you're finding it of interest. Certainly want to extend my invitation to those of you listening tonight to order your own copy from us. It is a four-hour series available either on four compact discs or a four-hour audio cassette program. The cost of the discs is $29.95 delivered. It's $24.95 for the four-hour series on audio cassette. In order to reserve your copy or order, you can give us a call at Kettle Moraine at 623-327-1778. That's 623-327-1778. And, you know, if you want to whoop out your matzah card, you can do that if you have to. But you know what? You can just drop us a check in the mail. Check, money order, cash, whatever you want to do. Address it to Kettle Moraine, K-E-T-T-L-E, just like a pot in a pan in a kettle. Moraine is spelled M as in mother, O-R-A-I-N-E, Kettle Moraine. Our address, 17750 West Elliott Road, that's E-L-L-I-O-T, Elliott Road, number 119. I can't even think tonight. 17750 West Elliott Road, number 119. And that is in Goodyear, Arizona, 85338. You can always find that address on the front page of the Federal Observer. And our chat room is open tonight, www.federalobserver.com. In addition, I want to take this opportunity to not only wish everybody a much happier and better and more prosperous new year than we had during the year of our Lord 2004, but also want to continue to extend my invitation to you to contribute to the program that you're listening to tonight, Sweet Liberty. And you may do that by sending your check or money order in care of Jackie Patru, P-A-T-R-U, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, M-I-L-L-E-R-T-O-N, Pennsylvania, 16936. You may leave the payee blank. You can make it out to WWCR. You can endorse your check or money order out to First Amendment Radio. But whatever you do, your contributions are needed. We're still trying to play catch-up with some of the backlog on this program. I am very thankful for the additional support that we have been able to assist Jackie in drawing in for this program. Once again, send your contributions as generous as you can. Come on, folks. Christmas is over. Don't give me the excuse of the tax man cometh. The tax man can't get it what he don't know you got. Send your contributions to Jackie Patru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA, 16936. Let's go back now to Chapter 3 of the Mask of Demetrios. Game, set, match.
It will discover
match, set, game, whatever.
At all, but it is in its manipulation. The things which are done, as Paul Warburg put it, in an administrative way. You see, the United States, other than maybe Andrew Jackson, has never had a president who gave evidence of understanding the matter of money at all. Our presidents have always had to take their views from financiers. Money is the most public quantity in this country. It is the most federalized and governmentalized thing in this nation, and yet in our ongoing situation, the United States government has hardly anything to do with money, except to use various means to get it, just as the people have to get it from those who control it. The money question, my friends, properly solved, is the end of the Jewish question and every other question of a mundane nature. Warburg was of the opinion that different rates of interest ought to obtain in different parts of the country, that they had always obtained in different parts of the same state we have always known, but the reason for it had never been discovered. The city grocer could get money from his bank at a lower rate than the farmer in the next county could get it from his bank. Why the agricultural rate of interest has been higher than any other when money is so easily obtainable? is not obtainable now. Although, in today's society, oh, there's all the money in the world available for a farmer, but there's quite a few more strings attached to the deal. What you can plant, how much you can plant, we'll pay you not to plant, but you'll have to pay us interest on the money we're going to loan you not to plant. All of which is a question to which no literary or oratorical financier has ever publicly addressed himself. You know, it's kind of like the fact of the private business nature of the Federal Reserve System. It's very important, but no authority thinks it worthwhile to state it. In the last 20 years, 25 years in Congress, the only two that had the guts to bring it up were Representative Ron Paul and the late Henry Gonzalez. In comparing the present Federal Reserve law with the original one proposed by Nelson Aldrich, Warburg stated thusly in his testimony, "I think that this present law has the advantage of dealing with the entire country and giving them different rates of discount, whereas, as Senator Aldrich's bill was drawn, it would have been very difficult to do that, as it provided for one uniform rate for the whole country, which I thought was rather a mistake." And Senator Bristow said, "Well, that is, you can charge a higher rate of interest in one section of the country under present law than you can charge in another section, while under the Aldrich plan it would have been a uniform rate. That is correct." Well, this becomes a point worth clearing up. You see, if Warburg, having educated the bankers, would have now turned his attention to the people and made it clear why one class in the country could get money for business that was not productive of real wealth, while another class engaged in the production of real wealth was treated as outside the interest of banking altogether. If Warburg could have made it clear, as could Greenspan today, also why money is sold to one class or one section of the country at one price, while to another class and in another section it's sold at a different price, both Warburg then and Greenspan today could be adding to the people's grasp of the matters. But then that's not what they have in mind now, is it? They don't want us to have a grasp of the matters. That suggestion was seriously intended. Warburg had the style, the pedagogical patience, the grasp of the subject, which would have made him an admirable public teacher of the matters, but they don't want the public educated. Consider how Greenspan testifies before Congress today. Do you understand one word that comes out of his mouth? No, of course not. And nor does the Congress that he is intimidating and testifying before. You see, what Warburg did then, and Greenspan and his eventual successors will continue to do today, was plan from the point of view of the interest of the professional financier. It was readily granted at that time that Warburg desired to organize American finances into a more, shall we say, pliable system. Doubtless, in some respects, he had wrought important improvements, but he had always the banking house in mind, and he dealt with the paper. If he had the banking house in mind, who did he have in mind? You and I? The inheritors of this system? The children, the grandchildren of those who were alive during the founding of the Federal Reserve? Of course not. If taking up a position outside those special interests, if Warburg then and Greenspan now would have addressed themselves to the wider interest of the people, not assuming that those interests always run through a banking house, they could do more. He would do still more than he had yet done to justify his feeling that he really had a mission coming to this country. But his mission was a mask, was it not? A mask of Dimitrios? You see, Warburg was not at all shocked by the idea that the Federal Reserve System was really a new kind of private banking control, because in his European experience, he saw that all the central banks were private affairs. Warburg wrote a rather lengthy essay entitled American and European Banking Methods and Bank Legislation Compared. And in it, Warburg states, "It may also be interesting to note that contrary to a widespread idea, the central banks of Europe are, as a rule, not owned by the governments. As a matter of fact, neither the English, the French, or the German government owns any stock in the central bank of its country. The Bank of England is run entirely as a private corporation, the stockholders electing the board of directors who rotate in holding the presidency. In France, the government appoints the governor and some of the directors. In Germany, the government appoints the president and a supervisory board of five members, while the stockholders elect the board of directors. And again, Warburg continues in his discussion of the Owen Glass Bill. And I'm not going to attempt to do this accent because it's a rather lengthy dissertation and I don't particularly care to do in the shall we say, Brooklynese. The Monetary Commission's plan, Warburg goes on, proceeded on the theory of the Bank of England, which leaves the management entirely in the hands of businessmen without giving the government any part in the management or control. The strong argument in favor of this theory is that central banking, like any other banking, is based on sound credit, that the judging of credits is a matter of business that which should be left in the hands of businessmen, and that the government should be kept out of business. The Owen Glass Bill proceeds in this respect more in the lines of the Banque de France and the German Reichsbank, the presidents and boards of which are, to a certain extent, appointed by the government. These central banks, while legally private corporations, are semi-governmental organs, inasmuch as they are permitted to issue the notes of the nation, particularly where they are elastic note issues, as in almost all countries except England, and inasmuch as they are the custodians of practically the entire metallic reserve. You read it? Gold and silver. They are the custodians of practically the entire metallic reserves of the country and the keepers of the government funds. Moreover, in questions of national policy, Warburg concludes, the government must rely on the willing and loyal cooperation of these central organs. Well, my friends, that's a very illuminating passage, is it not? It would be well worth the listener's time, especially a listener who has always been puzzled by financial matters, to turn over in his mind the facts here given by a great Jewish financial expert about the central bank idea. Observe these phrases. Without giving the government any part in the management or control. These central banks, while legally private corporations, are permitted to issue the notes of the nation. They are custodians of practically the entire metallic reserves of the nation and the keepers of the government funds. And finally, in questions of national policy, the government must rely on the willing and loyal cooperation of these central organs. Notice in his third comment, they are custodians of practically the entire metallic reserves. You see, it's now a question of whether these things were right or wrong. It's merely a question of understanding that they constitute the fact. It becomes specifically notable that in paragraph D, the one that says, in questions of national policy, the government must rely on the willing and loyal cooperation of the central organs. It is a fair deduction that in questions of national policy, the government will simply have to depend not only on the patriotism, but also to an extent on the permission and counsel of the financial organizations. I'd say it's a pretty fair interpretation. Questions of national policy are, by this method, rendered dependent upon the financial corporations, i.e., the banks, i.e., the controlling interests of those banks. Warburg stated that he believed in a certain amount of government control, but not too much. He said, in strengthening the government control, the Owen Glass Bill therefore moved in the right direction, but it went too far and fell into the other, an even more dangerous extreme. Well, the more dangerous extreme was, of course, the larger measure of government supervision provided for and the establishment of a number of Federal Reserve banks out across the country. Paul Warburg considered 12 regional Federal Reserve banks to be a dangerous extreme. Well, he'd referred to this before, and he'd agreed to the larger number only because it seemed to be an unavoidable political concession. already been shown by Professor Seligman that Warburg was alive to the necessity of veiling a little here and a little there and putting on a little yonder for the sake of conciliating a suspicious public. There was also the story of the bartender and the cash register. Yeah, I'll show you how to wake it, but I'm not going to show you how to make it wake. Mr. Warburg thought he understood the psychology of America. In that respect, he reminds one of the reports of Mr. von Bernstorff and Capital Boyette of what the Americans were likely to do or not to do. In Political Science Quarterly, dated December of 1920, Warburg told Howe, on a then-recent visit to Europe, that he was asked by the men of all countries what the United States was going to do. He assured them that America was just a little tired by then, but that she would come around all right. And that, harking back to his efforts of placing his monetary system on the Americas, he said, I asked them to be patient with us until after the election, and I cited to them our experiences with monetary reform. I reminded them how the Aldrich plan had failed because at the time, a Republican president had lost control of a Congress ruled by a Democratic majority. How the Democrats, in their platform, damned this plan and any central banking system. And how once, in full power, the National Reserve Association was evolved, not to say camouflaged, by them into the Federal Reserve System. Remembering that play before the public, my friends, and the play behind the scenes, this camouflaging, as Warburg says, of one thing into another, he undertook to assure his friends in Europe that regardless of what the political platform said, the United States would do substantially what Europe hoped it would do. Warburg's basis for that belief was, as he said, his experience with the way the central bank idea went through in spite of the advertised objections of all parties. He believed then that with Americans, it was possible to get what you want if you just play the game skillfully. And his experience with monetary reform seems to have fathered that belief in him. Politicians may be necessary pawns to play in the game, in any game, but as members of the government, Warburg did not want them in banking. They were not bankers, he said. They don't understand. Banking is nothing for a government man to meddle with. He may be good enough for the government of the United States, but he's not good enough for banking. In our country, Warburg said, referring to the United States, with every untrained amateur a candidate for any office, where friendship or help in a presidential campaign, financial or political, has always given a claim for political preferment, where the bids for votes and public favor are ever present in the politician's mind. A direct government management, that is to say, a political management, would prove fatal. There can be no doubt, but that, as drawn at present, which at that time was 1913, with two cabinet officers, members of the Federal Reserve Board, and with vast powers vested in the latter, the Owen Glass Bill will bring about direct government management. And that, of course, in Warburg's mind, was not only dangerous, but fatal. Warburg had almost his whole will in the matter. And what, my friends, was the result? Turn to the testimony of Bernard Baruch when he was examined with reference to the charge that certain men close to President Wilson had profited to the extent of $60 million in stock market operations, which they entered into on the strength of advanced information of what the president was to say in his next war note, the famous leak investigation, as it was called, one of the several investigations in which Mr. Baruch was closely questioned. In that investigation, Baruch was laboring to show that he had not been in telephone communication with Washington, especially with certain men who were supposed to have shared the profits of the deals. The time, December 1916, Warburg was then safely settled on the Federal Reserve Board, which he had kept quite safe from government intrusion. And the chairman of the investigating committee states, of course, the records of the telephone company here, the slips, will show the persons with whom you talked. And Baruch says, do you wish me to say, sir? I will state who they are. Yes, I think you might. I called up two persons. One, Mr. Warburg, whom I did not get, and one, Secretary McAdoo, whom I did get, both in reference to the same matter. Would you like to know the matter? Yes, I think it is fair that you should state it. I called up the secretary because someone suggested to me, asked me to suggest an officer of the Federal Reserve Bank, and I called him in reference to that and discussed the matter with him, I think two or three times. But it was suggested to me that I make the suggestion, and I did so. You ever heard so much double talk in your life? Ladies and gentlemen, this is supposedly congressional testimony by Bernard Baruch, and I never heard such a convoluted bunch of garbage in my absolute life. I think two or three times it was suggested to me, I make the suggestion, and I did so. And Mr. Campbell comes back and says, Mr. Baruch, who asked you for a suggestion for an appointee for the Federal Reserve Bank here? Mr. E.M. House. Mr. Campbell says, did Mr. House tell you to call Mr. McAdoo up and make the recommendation? He says, I will tell you exactly how it occurred. Mr. House called me up and said there was a vacancy on the Federal Reserve Board. And he said, I don't know anything about these fellows down here, and I'd like you to make a suggestion. And I suggested the name, which he thought was a very good one. And he said to me, I wish you'd call up the secretary and tell him. And I said, I don't see the necessity. I'll tell you. No, he said, I prefer you call him up. Well, here we have an example of the Federal Reserve kept out of politics, kept away from government management, which would not only be dangerous, but, in Warburg's words, once again, fatal. Bernard Baruch, the New York stock plunger who never owned a bank in his life, was called up by Colonel E.M. House, the arch politician of the Wilson administration, and thus the great Federal Reserve Board was supplied another member. A telephone call kept within a narrow Jewish circle and settled by a word from one Jewish stockbroker that, in a practical operation, was Mr. Warburg's great monetary reform. Baruch calling up Warburg to give the name of the next appointee of the Federal Reserve Board and calling up McAdoo, Secretary of the United States Treasury, and set in motion to do it by Colonel Edward Mandel House. Is it any wonder the Jewish mystery in the American government grows more and more amazing? And ladies and gentlemen, we're 90-odd years later. And look at the Jewish control that resides within earshot of President Bush, our leader, as we record this series of programs. But you see, Warburg himself wrote, friendship or help in a presidential campaign, financial or political, has always given a claim to political preferment. And as Warburg urged, this is a country with every untrained amateur a candidate for office. And naturally, with such men compromising the government, they must be kept at a safe distance from monetary affairs. And as if to illustrate the ignorance thus charged, along comes Baruch, who quotes Colonel House as saying, I don't know anything about these fellows down there, and I'd like you to make a suggestion. It is permissible to doubt that Baruch correctly quotes House, but it is permissible to doubt that all the Colonel House confessed was his ignorance about those fellows. Oh, don't kid yourself. There was a great understanding between those two men. Too good an understanding for the alleged telephone conversation to be taken strictly at face value. It's quite possibly true that House was not a financier. Certainly Wilson was not. President Wilson. In the long roll of presidents, only a handful have been, and those who have been regarded as most drastic in their proposals. But this whole matter of ignorance, as charged by Warburg, sounds like an echo of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion when he states, the administrators chosen by us from the masses will not be persons trained for government, and consequently, they will easily become pawns in our game, played by our learned and talented counselors, specialists educated from early childhood to administer world affairs. As we shared with you earlier, during this chapter, chapter 3 of the Mask of Demetrius, in the 20th protocol, wherein the great financial plan of world subversion and control was disclosed, there was another mention of the ruler's ignorance of financial problems. And therefore, my friends, it becomes a coincidence that while he did not use the term ignorance, Warburg was quite outspoken concerning the benighted state in which he found this country, and he was also outspoken about the untrained amateurs who were candidates for every office. These, he said, are not fit to take part in the control of monetary affairs. But Warburg was. And how do we know that? Because Warburg said so. He admitted that it was his ambition from the moment he came here as an alien Jewish German banker to change our financial affairs more to his liking. And more than that, my friends, he succeeded. He himself said, more than most men do in a lifetime, that he had succeeded. Professor Seligman says, to such an extent that throughout history, the name of Paul M. Warburg and that of the Federal Reserve System should be united. And we reach the end of Chapter 3. Chapter 3, The Mask of Dimitrios. This series was an interesting one, how it came about to begin with. A good friend of mine, Trucker Bob down in Florida, on one of his treks out here to Arizona, stopped in, and we had a long discussion about a number of things, and we were discussing what could be looked upon as a follow-up to our original series, All the King's Men, which, for those of you who heard it, was a dissertation of the manipulation and control of the stock market collapse in 1929. The Mask of Dimitrios, in many respects, becomes a prequel to all of that. Tonight's episode, Game, Set, Match, or Match, Set, Game, I don't know. We will consider airing Chapter 4 next week. I need to get on about some business here. I'm not here to just take care of myself and fill in, and, you know, we're certainly here to help contribute to Sweet Liberty, which is what you've been listening to tonight, and I thank you for tuning in and listening to us. I certainly want to wish each and every one of you a very good new year, and I don't just mean the holiday, but take care of yourselves. Don't forget those donations out to Jackie next week, Mask of Dimitrios, Chapter 4, Checkmate. Without apology, on behalf of Jackie Petru, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
You have been listening to Jackie Petru's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petru, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support, and stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.